are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Tuesday, October 22nd, 2019. I'm Michael Brooks on a Sam-Michael Hybrid Tuesday. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Pamela Newkirk on Diversity, Inc. Interview Sam just recorded hot off of the presses. India and Pakistan trade fire in Kashmir, killing nine in one of the most contentious areas in the globe. Even as the Indian military occupation of Kashmir continues months after the Modi government scrapped the Indian constitution to strip autonomy for Kashmir. Not to worry, there's a great new photo op with the prime minister, along with Henry Kissinger, Condoleezza Rice, and Tony Blair. I'm sure that they are centering humanity in those talks. Oh, and by the way, the Indian economy is collapsing. U.S. diplomat Bill Taylor, drawn into Trump's Ukraine efforts, set to testify on Tuesday. Support for impeaching and removing Donald Trump is at an all-time high, according to a CNN poll.
Fake news.
Fake news. It's the fake news, folks. Ain't nothing fake about what the hell is going on with Donald Trump's face, as you'll see. Iran says U.S. forces withdrawing from Syria have no approval to stay. Workers at Chilean copper mine, the world's largest, are set to walk off the job today. Canadian elections, Trudeau hangs on to power, just one shade of makeup on, as the NDP performs pretty well. There's going to be some type of coalition government. The MAGA chud Dave Rubin guest, Bernier, not only did not lead a new fascist party in Canada, he lost his own seat. Netanyahu cannot form a government. Israel might be headed to another set of elections. There is no difference from the perspective of Palestinian humanity on the ballot. Trump has discovered what the Emoluments Clause is, and it's phony. It's phony, folks. All that, plus the movement continues in Haiti against occupying forces, the World Bank, IMF, and the corrupt political class. And a new book whacks Kamala Harris's AG record during the housing crisis. Important history, but maybe not as important a candidate as people might have thought. You know, when she said, "I'm a top-tier candidate," that was like bad karma.
Yeah, she seemed like someone who would do well in the Democratic Party of
totally.
Today.
I think that's my biggest miscall of the election. I totally thought Kamala Harris was going to be solid. Donald Trump is in a bad mood. He had to reverse himself from hosting the G7 at one of his own hotels. And as Mick Mulvaney said, I mean, he still really thinks of himself as being in the hospitality business. I mean, what's more hospitality than being president of the United States? This clip is great. One, I just want to do, and I'm loath to do this, as everybody knows, I'm not into this stuff, but I do want to give a trigger warning. His face is horrifying. I'm not going to do like a fake woke thing about people's bodies. Whatever is going on here, whatever bleach he's using and how that's counteracting with the thing on his head, it's a tough deal.
Well, so, Oompa Loompas are a historically marginalized group, so you might want to be a bit sensitive.
I mean, fair enough. If he comes out and owns his identity as whatever that is, I will try to be more sensitive. As of now, this is just a really terrifying tanning job, which cannot be adding to a already... I mean, this is not... There's Trump when he's funny. There's Trump when he's dunking on Jeb. There's Trump when he's talking about, you know, Democratic candidates and he's loose. I just had to cancel the hotel.
Bitchy Trump.
Very, bitchy Trump. And when Trump is bitchy, there's one person that comes to mind.
They ran their business. Hey, Obama made a deal for a book. Is that running a business? I'm sure he didn't even discuss it while he was president. He has a deal with Netflix. When did they start talking about that? That's only, you know, a couple of examples. But other presidents, if you look, other presidents were wealthy. Not huge wealth. George Washington was actually considered a very, very rich man at the time. But they ran their businesses. George Washington, they say, had two desks. He had a presidential desk and a business desk. I don't think you people with this phony emoluments clause. And by the way, I would say that it's cost me anywhere from $2 to $5 billion to be president. That's okay between what I lose and what I could have made.
Oh, my God. Okay, definitely being president is absolutely the first solid. Look, Donald Trump as a businessman is a failure. Donald Trump as an entertainer is pretty successful. And being president is by far, I think that is originally why he ran for president, was probably because this is a way to actually reach oligarch status, not just like in my vision board, would be my guess. So that's great. Now, you know, look. Do presidents leave office, and do they even know that something in the future is going to influence their decisions today, even if it's not as naked and obvious as Trump? Yeah, probably. And this is like the classic Trump pattern where he sort of like in his own narcissistic, self-victimizing, whiny way makes like a third of a point. But the fact check is really funny. And I also do like the idea that like, what's the difference between getting a book agent after you're president and booking people to stay at your hotels? It's all the same thing. George Washington, they say chop down the cherry tree. Say chop down the cherry tree. He owned slaves. That's a significant business.
I love the projection like Obama had Reed Hastings in the White House. Like, nudge, nudge, Reed. Yeah. You know what's going to happen when I'm not
had Reed over, did a great deal. Great business guy. Netflix is a great business. But people don't want me to make deals.
We're supposed to be incredibly cynical about Obama, but all these instances with Trump and all this, all his emoluments issues, were supposed to act like
no, it's just like
I didn't.
Yeah, say, asking the Saudi royal family if they want to stay at my hotels before a major arms deal is the most innocent, commonsensical thing in the world. Barack Obama getting a book deal is sinister.
And like, how much money does he make off of any of these stays? Like, it seems like a little petty.
I don't even know. I just know that I'm in the hospitality business. I had one desk for business, one desk for work. A monuments clause. Ridiculous. Fake news.
Many thousands, Jamie.
Fake news. Sat down with Netflix. They're a great company. I'm a great president. We do great business. Did deals.
They should just give him a really good reality show and tell him that, you know, being president is going to be more like you want it to be now. And then, you know, we can have another place where the real president is.
If he loses, they should pretend that he wins and get him into the simulation.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Okay, yeah, yeah. So he thinks. No, but I'm saying he needs to think that.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
The whole time, yeah.
Like,
we need to get him into the.
You won.
You won, and now all of a sudden you have a 95% approval rating. And all of the best entertainers want to come this time.
And it's a reality show. And that part will be real because it'll be hilarious.
Oh, yeah. We'll definitely watch that. It'll be like the Truman Show. I'm totally into that concept. Because I still want Trump to have a highly active Twitter account until he dies.
Big time. Big league.
I just want to say, apropos of nothing, this is a Trump quote from 2013, and this is a good example of why I still want him on Twitter, and why what Kamala Harris is saying is just not only problematic politically, it's just a huge assault on entertainment. This is Donald Trump from 2013. New York Fashion Week is really bad. It used to be so glamorous and exciting. No stars, no fun, just boring. They need serious help. Hashtag New York Fashion Week.
All right. I'm sure he misses the big hair and shoulder pads.
Of course he does.
You could just walk into the dressing room.
Oh, Jesus. Humans have been shaving for thousands of years, but the secret to a great shave hasn't changed much. That's why Harry's doesn't overcharge you to add gimmicky features to their razors. Harry's is a return to the essential. Quality, durable blades at a fair price. Just two per blade. Just $2 per blade. They've cut out the middleman by manufacturing blades in their German blade factory, which has been honing precision blades for a century. That means you get incredibly high-quality blades at factory-direct prices. There's no risk trying them out. If you don't love your shave, you let them know and they'll get you a full refund. Listeners of our show now can redeem their Harry's trial set at harrys.com/majority report. You'll get a weighted ergonomic handle for a firm grip, a 5-blade razor with lubricating strip and trimmer blade, a rich lathering shave gel with aloe to keep your skin hydrated, and a travel blade cover to keep your razor dry and easy to grab on the go. Go to harrys.com/majority report to start shaving better today. Would you rather be busy or productive, Matlock?
Productive, obviously.
Start making your work take less work and find the right software for you at Captera.com/majority. Captera is the leading free online resource to help you find the best software solution for your business. With over 1 million reviews of products from software users, discover everything you need to make an informed decision. Search more than 700 specific categories of software. Everything from project management to email marketing to yoga studio management software. No matter what kind of software your business needs, Captera makes it easy to discover the right solution fast. Join the millions of people who use Captera each month to find the right tools for their business. Now, Sam, I can tell you, I'm actually starting to get on Captera for my business, and I've been reading the reviews. And like Sam, I have to admit, I have been reading about all sorts of businesses that I have nothing to do with, because it is actually kind of fascinating to understand, like, how does somebody run a yoga studio, as an example? It's actually really interesting.
Actually, some of the software we use to run this show is listed on Captera.
That's right. And this show has been significantly more efficient as this group of humans can be, because of Captera solutions. Visit Captera.com/majority for free today to find the tools to make an informed software decision for your business. Captera.com/majority. That's CAPTERRA.com/majority. Captera, software selection simplified. All right, folks, we're going to take a brief break, and then we're going to be right back with Sam's conversation with Pamela Newkirk, Diversity Inc.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program professor of journalism at New York University, author of her latest, The Failed Promise of a Billion-Dollar Business, Diversity Inc. Pamela Newkirk, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Sam.
Let's first start, I guess, with what that billion-dollar business is before we get on to the failed both the promise and the failure, I guess.
Right.
Because I'm not sure that people are totally savvy as to the existence of diversity as an industry.
Right, and it's kind of a different way of thinking of it. But so I guess I'll start at the beginning. When I was thinking about this project, what brought me to it was just constantly reading these reports by companies like Google. Like every year they would look at their diversity numbers and issue a report, and every year they would talk about the disappointing results. And then I also kept reading about these institutional scandals, if you will, where, there was some revelation either about a racial episode in the workplace that then, would cause the company, the institution, the higher diversities are. And then, you know, I just started reading about all of the money that is spent on diversity by various institutions every year. The task forces that are assembled and the climate surveys that are commissioned and the diversity consultants that are hired and the diversity czars and the diversity conferences that draw hundreds of people to cities around the country, and then started thinking of it as an industry. And we're looking at an industry that is actually growing by leaps and bounds, particularly over the past couple of years with the rise in movements like Me Too and Black Lives Matter. Diversity jobs are on the rise. There was a study by Indeed.com that showed that the numbers had gone up something like 35% over the last couple of years. The postings for diversity jobs. So we're talking about an industry. A professor at MIT more than 10 years ago had said at that time companies were spending something like $8 billion a year on diversity. And since that time, the numbers have gone up. So we're talking about a burgeoning industry.
And maybe I'm jumping ahead just a little bit, but I mean, from your perspective, and we should say that, you know, one of the books you wrote, Within the Veil, Black Journalists, White Media, sort of, I guess, extrapolated on the problem on some level.
Right. How we're not really making the progress that one would think we would have made over 50 years of looking at this issue and grappling with this issue.
And I want to get to that because that's the failed promise, I guess. But does is there a way to maybe even make this assessment? But when we see the reaction of, you know, the sort of the apparatus, right, to increase diversity, how sincere, you know, and we could talk about the efficacy of this apparatus and why it has not been effective, but how sincere is the effort, do you think? I mean, because we do see it in reaction to like, oh, we had employees who removed, two black people from our store because, and now we've got to, we're going to have all this training. Like, how
right.
sincere?
We're going to have this big, like, public kind of.
Right. How much of it is public relations and how much of it is a sense? I mean, how much of it is, to what extent can you attribute what motives to it, I guess?
Right. Well, only the institutional leaders can honestly say how sincere they are. I can only look at the results of their efforts, that they're spending billions of dollars on something and getting and having very little to show for it and doing the same thing over and over that is not bearing results. So I'm just wondering why. When you keep doing the same thing and getting the same results, then maybe you need to try something new, right? That's in part what inspired me to look at this, because it's like we're having the same conversations for decades, the exact same conversations, you know, looking at these numbers where black law partners increased from 1.7% to 1.8% between 1985 and 2016, looking at black men in management at companies with 100 or more employees going from 3% to 3.2% over years. The largest public fashion and apparel companies, where only 11% of board seats are held by people of color who comprise roughly 40% of the population. So if all of these companies are spending, you know, some hundreds of millions and, you know, collectively billions of dollars a year and having so little to show for it, like, what could we do differently? What new ways might we look at a systemic problem? because surely what's happening now is not working.
All right. And before we get to sort of like that concept of solution, and I think, you know, you give obviously the statistics that you just laid out for us are indicative, you know, across any number of industries in a myriad of different ways. You talk about the entertainment industry as well in that regard. The relevance of the question, I mean, obviously you can't assess intent, but right. Are there indications, and it sounds like this is an agenda driven question, but it's not.
Right.
but I'm just curious to what extent, like, is mission accomplished simply by showing the expenditure?
I think that's the approach that many of these institutions are taking, that to simply construct an apparatus of diversity is indication of enough that institution cares about diversity. And I'm not certain that many institutional leaders are owning their role in the result part of it. Like, you know, they're kind of farming it out to a consultant or to some marginalized division within the institution, instead of actually saying that, you know, this is something that I as a leader need to incentivize. You know, when leaders of companies actually care about something,
right.
they can move the needle. If they don't farm it out and actually say the buck stops with me, you could see this problem pretty much, you could see progress pretty much overnight in many institutions if that kind of intention is brought to bear. So I think, you know, when you ask me how sincere they are, I mean, they may think they're sincere, they may be sincere, but if this was another kind of problem that affected their bottom line and they were failing consistently, I would just imagine that, you know, if you're a CEO of a company and things are failing and you're throwing a lot of money at it, you're going to want to try something different. And so I think with this problem, I think there needs to be some serious soul searching to find out why we're doing the same thing if it's not working.
Right. I mean, if the agenda was in a company, we need to increase our sales in this region of the world. And, right. You know, 3 years later, I look at it and like it hasn't moved a needle. I would say we need to do something different. I mean, that's
right.
What I guess. I mean, so
yes. And if every year you're releasing reports that saying, oh, we're disappointed, like you're going to be disappointed for decades. Like at what point do you take responsibility for that failure? Who does that failure belong to? Like who gets to own that failure? And I think the way it's been looked at is you can blame a consultant or you can blame, you know, the diversity czar. You can blame it's out there. You know, the finger is pointing outward when it really should, you know, go in the other direction. It's a systemic problem, and it's a leadership issue in a lot of these situations.
Well, if it is, I mean, let's look at it from the perspective of the systemic qualities of it. I mean, because I think the idea that there isn't a reevaluation of the methodology suggests to me that there isn't necessarily a feeling of genuine failure, that the attempt is sufficient for a lot of the people who are doing this to fulfill what is the actual problem, which is the perception that they're
right. And I Right. And I think perception has a lot to do with this, too. I think many people have still clung to this mythology that, you know, people of color are not in these positions because there are not enough qualified people of color, or there are, you know, the problem is the pipeline. That's a critique that you heard a lot in the 1960s when diversity became, you know, sort of like a public, you know, a social concern, you know, from the president on down. This is something that we need to address. There was an acknowledgement that African Americans and other people of color had been systemically shut out of most fields. But in that time, in the 50 years that have since then, it's no longer possible to point solely to a pipeline issue when you've had scores of people of color going through not only just college, but some of the most elite schools in this country. And yet we still have this problem where we're saying, you know, we tried and, you know, we just kind of throw up our hands. And it's like, no, let's do a little bit more than that. Let's really look. So something that Coca-Cola did after it was sued for discrimination and it settled, what it did is it looked at the metrics across the company. It looked at hiring, promotions, bonuses, who was getting, who was not, by racial group, by gender. And then they were able to both identify patterns of bias and to disrupt those patterns of bias in real time. So they would look at these metrics even before a job offer was made, even before you know, bonuses or you know, raises were given, to see, are there patterns of bias? You know, a lot of this is not intentional bias, right? But you know, we live in a racialized society where you know, ideas are deeply embedded and they play out in ways that are kind of insidious. We don't often see it. It's sort of an invisible thing. But if you look at the metrics in this way, then maybe you can, like, make some adjustments. So this is just one way that a company kind of turned itself around and became a lot more racially diverse.
Can you give us a more granular examples in that way? So in other words, you would look in the different divisions of Coca-Cola, but you would look in distribution and
right. So you'd look at people in the same job and see, okay, like what are the salaries across that job category? What if you're hiring, what does the applicant pool look like? What does who's getting bonuses? So if you look at that across the board and you kind of, like, you know, do that kind of assessment, you can actually see patterns. And so that's how they did it.
And then they would say to the human resources in those different divisions, look, you are your rate of hiring is much lower based upon the applicant pool you have, or another division. Your bonuses are making people conscious of that.
Of disparities, right. Making people a lot more conscious of these patterns of disparity. So that's one way. And I mean, obviously that took intention. It took you know, vigilance, but that's what they did, and that's how they turned Coca-Cola around. So there are models that exist, you know, but if you look in higher education, where African Americans are about 4% of university professors and Latinos are 3% or under, in a country where those two groups alone are about 30% of the population, you know, something needs to, like, there should be some way to look at what's going on with who's, not only who's hired, who's even considered for these positions.
To what extent, is there a pipeline problem or a maybe, I mean, a culture, there's obviously a cultural problem insofar as you have these disparities in the way that maybe people perceive. But I, you know, a while back we interviewed, maybe I guess it was over the summer, Anthony Abraham Jack, who wrote a book, I think it was called The Privileged Poor, about how elite colleges are failing disadvantaged students, where it, you know, one of the things he looked at was particularly African-American students who were, you know, coming from living, you know, in poverty or down further on the income distribution, and that colleges would seek out African-American students. They were more apt to admit them if they had already been acculturated in a private school in some way. And I wonder to,
I guess that their defense is that they want students who can compete with their peers, and they don't want to set students up to fail. But I guess what I want to say about this is that, you know, I think you're talking about the pipeline. And as I said, for 5 decades, we've talked about the pipeline. For many of these fields, that's no longer the issue, because what I found is that the more elite, the smaller, the more boutique a field is, the less diverse it is. So we're talking about oftentimes like newsrooms where we're not talking about large numbers of people.
Right.
We're talking about, like, if you only took one elite journalism school and just considered candidates from that one elite journalism school, you could turn around newsrooms like pretty much overnight with diversity. So I think, you know, the higher up you go, the more elite the field or you know, museums. We're not talking about needing, you know, thousands of people. I think it's why companies like Coca-Cola, you know, corporate America is far more diverse than some of the more elite progressive fields. You know, we look at journalism, we look at, you know, all the other higher ed. It doesn't take that many people to move the needle on this, but yet we're not really moving the needle.
Okay, so if I understand what you're saying, you know, that you're talking about, you know, Coca-Cola hires thousands of people.
Exactly.
Whereas, you know, thousands of people may include everybody who works in broadcast media in New York City.
Right.
And that in terms of getting percentages, much easier to find candidates, you know, enough, theoretically, but so
right.
Let me ask you this. Is it, and I guess what I was getting at with bringing up, that other, research was that is the issue that there are sort of like, I guess there are cultural streams or something like that, that people don't recognize and don't break out of, that, you know, that there is other factors at work, or they just, I mean,
well, there are definitely social networks. And
right.
I think a lot of this is due to social networks. I mean, I live in New York City, have, you know, I'm born and raised here, and I often attend events related to publishing or journalism or the arts. And oftentimes, I'm one of few people of color in the room. These are fields that in which people of color are acutely underrepresented. And I think these kind of segregated social spheres are then replicated in the workplace, because who do we hire? We hire who we know, who we're friends with, who our friends recommend. And I think, you know, we do live in a society in which we are pretty much socially segregated. And I think that then plays out in other ways. So I'm not talking about overt racism. I'm
right.
just talking
right.
about the natural ebb and flow of of our relations and what happens due to those relations. So who gets recommended for a faculty position? Who gets recommended for a great, you know, position at a radio station or a TV station or a newspaper? Oftentimes, it's not people who are not reflected in these very small social spheres. So I think that's a natural part of this. Yeah,
those things are downstream from more racist practices. Right?
Precisely. This has nothing to do. This is not racism. This is just the way we live in a society that has kind of been socially ordered this way. We live in a very, you know, we like to think of ourselves as living in a progressive, integrated society. But, you know, our churches are pretty much segregated. Our schools are pretty much segregated. Our you know,
where we
living
live.
Arrangements.
Right.
So, I mean, so this is all part and parcel of you know, how we find these workplaces, and particularly the more elite ones, are still very, very segregated.
And theoretically, a lot of these elite ones, too, probably have a more bearing, certainly when you talk about journalism, when we talk about entertainment on some level, more bearing on the culture in some ways, you know.
Precisely.
Okay, so how much of the argument of, you know, who our market is? I mean, for instance, I can tell you that I used to, years and years ago, I was a sitcom actor, and I did a sitcom where I played the white writer on an all-black variety show. It was a very early job I had. It was on Fox TV. I'm not doing an advertisement for myself. It's long gone. But it was really my first or second job in Hollywood. And it didn't occur to me until the decade that followed how rare it was that I was on a show where I was the only white guy, maybe there was one other white guy on the show, and everyone else was black, because, and the difficulty of a show like that, because of it, you know, or I should say, you know, the audience, the sell to the audience is very segregated. It's either got to be a black show or a white show.
But I think that's a really old fashioned way of looking at the world as it is today.
Well, I got to say, that was 25 years ago, but yes.
All of the research shows that more diverse casts are make more money. films with diversity make more money than films that don't have it. So I think that is the way that's a very old Hollywood way of looking at it, that you do a black cast for a black audience and a white cast for a white audience. Shonda Rhimes kind of like just exploded that whole myth by having diverse casts that are among the most popular shows on television. And we're seeing the same thing with film. The Hollywood Diversity Report, there are a number of reports that come out every year by USC and UCLA that show that diversity sells, and particularly in a global market that is more, you know, likely to gravitate to films that reflect the world. So, yeah, I think there was a time when that is the way that's what producers, directors, you know, people who greenlight projects thought of audiences, but that is not actually how audiences work. Look at some of the biggest films of the past couple of years. Black Panther, Crazy Rich Asians, you know, I can go on and on.
Well, I think
into that predictable, like, blacks for blacks and whites for whites. I mean,
I think the consumer facing aspect. No, I mean, I agree. And this show was, you know, in the mid-90s, and I think the consumer facing part of it now, I think, has changed. Yet you still have a problem with the producers in terms of like a lack of diversity. You still have a problem with the writers in terms of a lack of diversity. The people who aren't facing, you know, sort of consumer facing on some level. And, I guess my point was more just sort of the consciousness of the different networks that existed. Like I would, I never any of those men and women that I was on that show with. I never saw them again. Like,
exactly.
You know, at auditions.
So to the point about our separate social spheres. Yeah, yeah. No, I'm sure that's true. I mean, I can't tell you how many weddings or parties I've gone to of my white friends when I'm it.
So I understand you can, if you're a company the size of Coca-Cola, you can make these changes because you can actually, you have a lot of data.
Exactly.
If you're talking about a small, like a small journalism shop, or you're talking about, you know, even like a broadcast news, and you don't have that many people there, the data is not as sort of like obvious, right? Where, because like one person could change the percentage by, you know, a significant amount. How do you do it in that? Like, do you have examples in that situation where?
Yeah, I guess diversity just has to matter to a company. Matter not just, for the bottom line, but matter as just an issue of justice and what's right. Do we not hire people because they're of color? Does having diversity make us smarter, give us a broader take on the society that we're covering? I mean, can you really cover a diverse society with all white newsrooms, or can you do it fairly? Can you do it well? So I think when we think of diversity as more than just check a box, but as something that actually makes us better, then I think that might give news directors, managers, more of an incentive to do it because it just will make for a better product.
But what if they don't?
How you do it is it's really not that hard. I know at NYU when we have searches, because we have a far more diverse faculty now than when I joined the faculty 25 years ago, we have a much broader social network and professional network that, you know, that we have our tentacles out in the world and in a far more comprehensive way.
It becomes self-replicating on some level.
Precisely.
But
and if you don't have that and it's not self-replicating, it's not that hard, especially in journalism. I mean, we're journalists. We do research. How do we find people who don't look like us?
Well, what if there is not that?
Professional organizations, there are all kinds of ways to do it. It's really not. I think we treat diversity as like rocket science, like to do it is like so hard. It really isn't.
Well,
it
then
really isn't.
What if the answer is that there's a lot of these places that don't consider it important, and that they don't consider it important beyond the sort of the public relations aspect of it, which they feel is satisfied by expending money and saying we're doing our best?
Well, then we'll continue to have the consistently disappointing reports, and we'll just like accept that. I guess I'm calling it out because I mean, come on,
right.
It's like 50 years of saying the same thing. It's just, it doesn't go down well.
Such as the failed promise of a billion-dollar business, Diversity Inc. Pamela Newkirk, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam.
Thank you, Sam. Okay, folks, we're going to go to the fun half. Become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member. Today's show was brought to you in part by Capterra. Capterra is the leading free online resource to help you find the best software solution for your business. With over 1 million reviews of products from software users, from real software users, discover everything you need to make an informed decision. Go to Capterra.com/majority for free to find tools to make an informed software decision for your business. Capterra.com/majority. Capterra, that's Capterra.com/majority. Capterra, software selection simplified. Tonight on the Michael Brooks Show, we're going to be talking with John Iarola and Artesia Balthrop, talking about Extinction Rebellion and how not to mobilize people for a global environmental movement. We're talking about Lebanon, Chile, the Bernie rally, and much, much more. This past Sunday, an illicit history of how to build a global labor movement with Chuka Ejekman, which was really fascinating. Chuka Ejekman. So huge amount of content. I'll just say tonight I'm recording it, an interview with Adolf Reed, and then another interview that will be coming out with another very well-known person pretty soon as well, not confirmed yet, but we will be talking with the great Nina Turner on TMBS. The best people. Patreon.com/TMBS, Michael Brooks Show on YouTube. And tomorrow, we're a month out from our Philly show, of which we are well over. I think we're actually like 2/3 sold out of it. So I would get your tickets if you want to come see us in Philly. World Cafe, Crystal Ball, Artesia Balthrop, Emma Viglin. Super stoked. See you there. Jamie.
So this week on the Antifada, we had on not one, but two guests. We had Sham Khanna, the editor of Commune Mag, and Josh Strawn, who is in a band called Azar Swan, and he's also a thoughtful and political guy. So we previewed a bit of what's in the new issue of Commune. It sounds pretty cool. We talked about the Bernie rally that me, Andy, and Sham all went to. And then we talked a little bit about music. It's been a while since we've done a music episode, and we like music, and it's the month for spooky music. I mean, that's every month for me, but, you know, everyone enjoys spooky music in October. So we talked about some current music that we like, and we did something a little different than our usual format, and it was kind of a tie-in because Josh's band will be playing at my benefit show that I'm throwing for El Comedor, which is a mutual aid kitchen in Tijuana run along autonomous principles. And that's going to be Friday at Transpicos, kind of on the border between Brooklyn and Queens. And I've got Azar Swan and other bands that you guys probably haven't heard of, but are really awesome. It's going to be super goth and freaky and weird and fun and raise money for a good cause. So I hope some of you can come.
Rad. Links on the website, I'm assuming. Okay.
Yeah.
Matt.
Coming up this weekend on Literary Hangover, I'm going to be talking about the Salem Witch Trials. This is going to be a spooky episode, talking about it as a sort of violent transition from a theocratic to a secular age, and also as a cover-up of the Mather family, who spent the 1680s writing about how witches are real and you should take them seriously, and then find 1692 that
many
were getting
people
hung from.
Thought it was a cover up for the Mather family.
Like, yeah, find these witches, folks. Yeah, and then the Mathers were like, actually, we didn't. We would have been more cautious. But anyway,
fake news. They were like the early Trumps. They were just like, she has sunburn. She should be burned. 10 years later, I never said that. I never started anything with the witches.
Yeah, sort of like that. I'll have to think about how Trump maps onto the witch trials.
Yeah, please. I mean, come on. If you can't think of a Trump angle, then
I can't
filter it into modern parlance. God, that's depressing. All right, folks. We'll see you on the fun half. Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. One half. 5'8", 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd, don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you. You fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
This guy might be a Nazi.
Agreed.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands
up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.